Next on Blue Dot, we look at the universe on the grandest scale with the James Webb Space Telescope. It's scheduled for launch in 2018. We'll talk about it with Bonnie Meinke from the Space Telescope Science Institute. Then we'll hear from our social media correspondent, Casey Gardner. She spoke with NASA's Courtney O'Connor. She's responsible for the social media presence of the Juno spacecraft on Twitter. Favorite it and us, because we're all new and all blue right now. I'm Dave Schlom.
And I'm Nolan Ford. Dave, who is James Webb?
James Webb, yes. He was the second director of NASA during the Apollo program. And he was really responsible of getting the Apollo program through a very difficult time after the Apollo 1 fire that nearly derailed the whole going to the moon program in front of Congress. He fought to keep Apollo going. And if it wasn't for James Webb, you probably would have never heard of Neil Armstrong. So that's why he's a big hero to NASA and why the Next Generation Space Telescope is named after him. Our first guest is Dr. Bonnie Meinke. She's an education and outreach scientist with the Space Telescope Science Institute, which is responsible for the operation of the Hubble Space Telescope now and for the James Webb Space Telescope, which will take its place in space in 2018. Bonnie Meinke, PhD, welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
I like to call you by your Twitter handle. You want to know why?
Yes, I do.
Because if I just call you Dr. Meinke, I feel like I might get like a copay.
I don't want you to have to fork over that $15.
No, so I like Bonnie Meinke.
Feel free to call me Bonnie Meinke.
Bonnie Meinke, PhD, sounds great to me. Let's start with a little history. The James Webb Space Telescope was originally called the Next Generation Space Telescope because that's what it is. It's the next orbital observatory to take the place of Hubble. Can you give us a brief overview of when this was first proposed?
Well, there have been space telescopes proposed back to Spitzer. Lyman Spitzer was the first guy to come up with the idea of a space observatory, and he actually thought of a little astronaut sitting inside of that space observatory. Which is kind of fun to think about, but also not very practical. Think of how long it would take to do all these observations. It's much easier to have an automated system, kind of a remote robot up there in space doing all the observing for us. Lyman Spitzer came up with that back in the 60s, and since then, on every decadal review, there's these decadal reviews that scientists all sit down together every 10 years, and we discuss where astrophysics is going, what we want to learn, what the big questions are, and how we're going to answer those questions. What instruments, what machines, what collaborations we need to form to answer those big science questions. And since Lyman Spitzer, every decadal survey has come up with the idea of space telescopes. This was put into reality with the Hubble Space Telescope. And the Hubble Space Telescope has been so successful, going on almost 27 years now, that we decided that we needed the next generation of space telescope, and that was decided to be the James Webb Space Telescope. And there have been other space telescopes up there in the meantime doing specific things. There's something called the Great Observatories of NASA, and that includes Hubble, as well as the Chandra X-ray Observatory and the Spitzer Space Telescope. So Lyman Spitzer actually got a space telescope named after him. But as we move forward into the next decade, we wanted something that was another great flagship mission, and the space where all of the scientists agreed we needed to focus on was in the infrared. And that is how the Next Generation Space Telescope was born. A dedicated infrared observatory that would kind of push all of our science farther than the Hubble could, than the Spitzer Space Telescope could with its infrared capabilities, and go forward into this new millennia and into all of our big, deep science questions that we still have remaining.
Now, I was looking in an earth science textbook in my classroom today, and it said that the James Webb Space Telescope was going to be deployed in 2011, There's been some bumps along the road for the James Webb Space Telescope. At times, Congress hasn't exactly been supportive. Where did things go askew, and how did we get them back on track to where we're going to launch now in 2018?
Well, to be honest, I don't know the exact politics of how things kind of got to where they are now. I know that James Webb Space Telescope is one of the most ambitious space telescopes ever. It's, in fact, probably one of the most ambitious scientific collaborations of all time. And there are some big engineering challenges that were faced with making this telescope. And in doing so, you know, there are always going to be some cost overrides, some timeline overrides, and the James Webb Space Telescope is faced with both of those. But that's not unusual for a NASA mission. Hubble suffered the same thing, as well as a lot of famous planetary missions. Think of the Mars Curiosity rover. That overran its budget by almost double, and its timeline as well. But it's an amazing mission. We're getting amazing science back. So it really comes down to ambitious projects take a lot of resources. And it's worth the dedicated effort, the people working on it, the money it takes to do it, because we get fantastic science returns. So it's kind of assumed that this sort of thing will happen. We try to stay the budget, both in money and time, but it doesn't always happen. I'm not sure on the exact year, but sometime in the mid-2000s, we really got back on track with James Webb and the technologies, these Pathfinder technology proving tests that we were doing got on track, and we were able to build realistic timelines for their completion. And we also built in some slack time into our overall timeline to launch. So we're doing really well. We're on time, on schedule, on budget right now, and as we move forward, I think we've been able to convince our stakeholders, whether it be Congress or the American public or our international partners, that we're really going to make this happen. The mirrors were put into the telescope over the holidays, this last winter holiday session between, you know, December and January. Those went in on the timeline. We've integrated with the instrument panel. That went in on the correct timeline. So we've really proven over the last several years that we can stick to our timeline and our budget. We're really in those final phases of putting this whole thing together, and it's all coming together really well. We're really excited. We always have to be cautious, and that's why we still have some extra buffer time in our schedule. But we anticipate that everything is going to go according to plan. This is, like I said, some new technologies, some exciting engineering challenges that we're up to, and we've proven that we can do these things. But you kind of have to expect the unexpected with such a big, impressive challenge in engineering.
This is going to have an interesting orbit, too, isn't it? Can you tell us where that's going to be?
Yeah, so Webb will be about 1,000,000 miles from Earth on the other side of the moon. It's, in fact, about 3.5 times farther away from the Earth than the moon is. It's in this gravitational sweet spot called the second Lagrange point, or L2. And the reason I call it a gravitational sweet spot is because it stays behind the Earth so that the Sun, Earth, and telescope line up in a line for the whole year. So it stays basically behind the Earth, separated from the Sun, for the entire orbit of the Earth. In 1 year, it makes one orbit around the Earth.
So the Earth is constantly shielding it from the Sun.
Exactly.
Well, having a telescope out in space in orbit above the shielding and distorting effects of the atmosphere is hugely advantageous. How does the size of Webb compare with the largest ground-based telescopes when you compare them with this perspective, one on the ground versus one in space?
Well, I heard an interesting fact today, and this is actually about a different space telescope, but one of Webb Telescope's mirror segments, just one of the 18 segments, is bigger than the primary mirror of the Spitzer Space Telescope. So that's pretty big. We're talking about something that each segment is bigger than a meter. On the ground, our biggest space telescopes are on Mauna Kea in Hawaii, something like the Keck Observatory, or in Chile, there's several very large telescopes down there. And those are, we're talking 20 feet across, 30 feet across, something on that size scale. So we're sending up something to space that is about the size of the largest telescopes currently in existence on the ground on Earth.
You are listening to Blue Dot, and we are talking to Dr. Bonnie Meinke about the James Webb Space Telescope. We'll be back in just a moment. Let's compare Webb with Hubble. The Hubble Space Telescope is arguably the greatest scientific instrument ever built by humans. I should point out it had delays and cost overruns, and not to mention a disastrous beginning where the mirror was found to be out of figure, but we fixed all that. And it came up with just tremendous science and these iconic images. You know, you go to college dorm rooms across the country, you see those pictures from the Hubble Space Telescope in kids' dorm rooms. How does Webb stack up? What are some of the advantages it's going to have over Hubble?
Well, the biggest advantage, I would say, is that it will be in the infrared. Hubble has some amazing, some amazing, beautiful images that it's taken, and then some amazing science, but it's only looking in one wavelength of light. So it's like looking at the world with only one color, and that's very difficult to get the big picture of the universe by only looking in one color. So Hubble looks at the visible. That's exactly the same as what our eyes see. Hubble can also see a little bit in the ultraviolet and a little bit in the near infrared, which our eyes can't see, but it's basically what our eyes see. Webb is looking in the infrared, and that gives us an extra piece of the puzzle. So the other colors that we're seeing there will tell us about the first galaxies to be formed. That will tell us about planets forming around other stars. It will help us look through the gas and dust that's out there in these stellar nurseries, the birthplaces of stars, where planetary systems are forming around newly forming stars. And with that capability, we'll be able to piece together this bigger picture of how stars form, how planets form, how galaxies form. And that gives us a bigger piece of understanding of how we got here, which I think is a fundamental human question. How did we get here?
So what are some of the principal scientific goals for Webb?
Webb will answer three main questions, the three big NASA questions, which are, how did we get here? Are we alone? And how does the universe work? The way it will do that is by looking at specific scientific pieces, so specific pieces of what we like to call astrophysics, right? It's a big word, but it encompasses the individual objects out there in the universe. It'll be looking at the first light. That's the stuff that comes right after the Big Bang and right after the cosmic microwave background, where those first photons in the universe came out of that dark ages, the dark soup of the early universe. So we'll be looking at that first light from stars. We'll also be looking at the assembly of galaxies. So this is what I was saying with those first galaxies to form in the universe. We'll be looking back at those very, very small ancient galaxies. It's like looking at baby photos of our universe. We'll be looking at the birth of stars and protoplanetary systems, which is kind of tracing back where we came from and our solar system came from. We'll also be looking at planetary systems such as our own solar system. We can look at individual planets in our solar system, looking for different chemicals in atmospheres, the stuff that's on the surface, because in our own backyard of the solar system, we can do some great science from afar, from a space telescope, even without sending rovers to those planets. And that will help us learn a little bit more about the origins of life. And that's just what's planned. So I want to emphasize that even with a mission like Hubble, we had our main science goals, our main science themes upon launch. But what we actually learned blew that out of the water. One of the best examples is that with Hubble, we had no idea what was happening with the expansion of our universe. We knew that it was expanding because of the namesake of Hubble, but what we found was the universe accelerating in its expansion. And Hubble was key in figuring that out. So now we have a bigger, better cosmological picture of what's going on in our universe, and that wouldn't have been possible given just the main science goals at launch of Hubble. So I fully anticipate that whatever we discover with Webb will blow our current science goals out of the water.
We are talking to Dr. Bonnie Meinke. She's from the Space Telescope Science Institute. And Nolan, we were looking at a story in the news the other day. You want to ask Bonnie a question?
Yeah, recently in the news, we heard about the detection of an Earth-sized planet around the nearest star to us, Proxima Centauri. What kinds of observations could Webb make of this system, and what might it tell us about this intriguing world?
Well, Proxima Centauri is a red dwarf star, which is exciting because, as the name implies, with red in it, you can see part of it in the infrared. Well, if it also has a planet around it, it's possible that we can detect some of that heat of the planet as well. So we don't know too much about Proxima Centauri right now or this planet because it was detected by something called the radial velocity method. Really what we're looking at is the spectrum of that star as that planet tugs on it and wiggles it back and forth. So we know it's there, but we don't know a whole lot of other information about it. We don't necessarily know its mass, its size. We have estimates on those from how much it tugs on that star, and we expect it to be Earth-sized, but that could mean something 5 to 10 times the size of Earth. That's a range where it could be more like Neptune than Earth. So something like Webb could look at what the system is like and help us figure out if that the mass of that planet is actually more Earth-like, which helps us know that that planet may be rocky, which would be like the Earth. We do know Proxima Centauri because it is a red dwarf star, and we know that this planet has something like an 11-day orbit period, that it's in the habitable zone for that star, which is really exciting. It means liquid water could exist on the surface of that planet. if it is rocky. And that means that life could exist given liquid water on the surface. So one of the things Webb could look for potentially, and I'm not sure because I haven't done the calculation myself, I haven't looked at the orbital dynamics of the system, but with similar systems, James Webb Space Telescope would be able to look for signatures of water in the atmosphere of the planet if we were able to directly image that planet, or if we were able to see part of the atmosphere given a transit of that planet in front of the star from our line of sight. It's not just Proxima Centauri that we're talking about here. We're talking about other planets like it. There's other stuff in our solar neighborhood, and it's very exciting that we have something only 4 light years away that could potentially be habitable. But I would take, 10 light years away or 20 light years away, too. So there's a whole lot of planets out there that James Webb can look at and see if there are habitable planets that really do have liquid water on the surface.
For someone listening who might be wondering, what's the practical value, for a country doing a project like this? What would you like them to know about the worth of having an orbital observatory like Webb?
We get to answers to our biggest fundamental questions as human beings. We get to know, are we alone? How did we get here? How does the universe work? And I think that is fundamental to all of our existence, and I'm really excited about that.
For you personally, what most excites you about your work at the Space Telescope Science Institute?
I love getting to share my science with the general public. When a kid is excited about what I'm looking at, when a kid is excited about all of the planets that are out there, they've never known a world without extrasolar planets, without exoplanets. That's really exciting, and getting to share that excitement of looking at other planets around other stars really, really does it for me.
Bonnie, thank you.
Thank you. It's really fun.
Dr. Bonnie Meinke, PhD from the James Webb Space Telescope.
This is Blue Dot. I'm Casey Gardner, and my guest is Courtney O'Connor. Courtney is the public engagement lead for NASA's Juno mission. As you may know, Juno is the spacecraft that went into orbit around Jupiter on July 4th. So what exactly does being Juno's public engagement lead entail?
Let's see here. It's a little bit of everything. As a public engagement lead, I really spend most of my time working directly with the scientists and engineers on the Juno mission. So I do everything from attending the science team meetings to being part of the reviews that we have. And it's my job to translate the work that they're doing into something that the general public can enjoy.
I want to talk about social media and Twitter in particular. Last I checked, the Juno account has 450,000 followers. For those who aren't following you yet, though, what kinds of things are you tweeting about?
Well, Juno spent 5 years traveling from Earth to Jupiter, and on July 4th of this year, the spacecraft arrived. So what you can hear if you or read if you were to follow the account is a first-person perspective of the spacecraft as it's orbiting Jupiter as we try to peer within the planet and find out the history of our solar system.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. You write in first person as if Juno herself is tweeting us from space. Why did you guys decide to tweet that way as opposed to in third person?
So tweeting in first person, this is not a first for NASA. It goes all the way back to the Phoenix lander, which landed on Mars back in 2008. And that spacecraft, which came out of the news office here at JPL, also tweeted in the first person. And we found that the public really enjoys hearing from the rover as if it's on the surface of another planet. So since then, several spacecraft have followed this same approach. And we've just found that the public responds well, asks more questions, and it really captivates the attention of our audience.
Yeah, the tweets are often really funny. They're full of song lyrics and pop culture references. How did you come up with Juno's personality, and how would you describe it?
Well, each of our first-person spacecraft do have different personalities, and this one, it was actually somewhat easy to develop because the Juno spacecraft itself has a wonderful mythology to it. It was named after the Roman goddess Juno, who was married to Jupiter. And if you are not familiar with the story, it really was that Juno was able to see through Jupiter's many disguises. He liked to get into a lot of trouble and find out his true nature. So in a similar fashion, the Juno spacecraft went to Jupiter, is able to peer through the planet, and will reveal the secrets of our solar system. So the Juno Twitter account had to have that same type of confident feminist personality where she's going to Jupiter and she's going to really be able to find out what's going on there. So taking a lot of Beyonce lyrics, a lot of different female empowerment type of riffs with this account.
Have there been any tweets or moments in particular that stand out to you personally as being particularly fun or exciting?
Oh, well, the arrival night sure was exciting. That was being done minute by minute with all the different mission milestones going on. Of course, things are happening very, very fast-paced, and so when we found out that the spacecraft arrived safely, that was a very fun moment to tweet out.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Casey Gardner, and we're talking to Courtney O'Connor, who manages social media for NASA's Juno mission. NASA has really been on the forefront of government agencies successfully using social media to engage people in their mission. Courtney, how important have platforms like Facebook and Twitter become for that purpose?
Oh, it's been incredibly important for us. Part of NASA's directive is that we need to reach as wide of an audience as possible. And by using social media, we're able to reach an audience that we've never really been able to interact with directly before. So by using Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, you name it, we're able to communicate our message to as wide of an audience as possible.
What kind of guidelines, if any, do you get from NASA as to what you can and cannot say on social media?
I wouldn't say that we have guidelines per se. However, there is a NASA social media lead at headquarters and a team that works there. And we worked really closely together to make sure that everybody is in the loop and we know when new accounts are being created. And then in terms of making sure that I'm sending out the right messaging, it's always important that we are scientifically accurate, that we get the engineering right. So because I work so closely with the Juno mission, I can communicate with the team on a day-to-day basis.
And how do you approach a social media interaction if Juno makes a major discovery? I mean, it's one thing to make things fun and accessible, but how do you balance that with the serious magnitude of the mission?
Well, we do work with the media office here at JPL and at NASA, and all major news would go out through the typical channels. You know, there would be a NASA TV conference and press releases. However, social media would be just another way that we would communicate that to the public.
Are there any other events coming up in the mission where people might want to engage with you via social media?
Oh, yeah, coming up very soon on August 27th. That is when the spacecraft will finish her first lap around the planet, and we'll be going very close up, this time with all the science instruments turned on. So she'll have her eyes and her ears open, ready to share what she's learning about the planet.
Awesome. I can't wait to check that out. Courtney, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for talking to me. This was great.
That was Courtney O'Connor, Public Engagement Lead for the NASA Juno mission. I'm Casey Gardner, and you're listening to Blue Dot on NSPR.
Thanks to our guests, Courtney O'Connor from NASA's Juno mission, and thanks to our social media coordinator, Casey Gardner. Blue Dot is a production of NSPR, and you can check out past episodes or re-listen to this at mynspr.org. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Schlom. For Nolan Ford, I'm reminding you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.